Part 3. Alexandria, 125 BC. Bartimaeus. That morning, as on every morning, a little group of supplicants gathered outside the apartments of my master Ptolemy. They were there long before dawn, wrapped in their shawls, blue-legged and shivering, waiting patiently for the sun. As light spilled over the river, the magician's servants opened the doors and let them in, one by one. That morning, as on every morning, the list of complaints, wrongs, and outright woes was recited and considered. To some, advice was given. To a few, the more obviously covetous or deluded, help was refused. To the rest, action of one sort or another was promised and delivered. Imps and foliots departed through the windows and flitted out across the city on a variety of errands. A certain noble jinni was seen to leave, and in due course return. For several hours a steady stream of spirits came and went. It was a very busy household. At 11:30 the doors were shut and locked for the day. Thereafter, by a back route, to avoid lingering petitioners who would have delayed him, the magician Ptolemy departed for the library of Alexandria to resume his studies. We were walking across the courtyard outside the library building. It was lunchtime, and Ptolemy wished to get anchovy bread in the markets on the quay. I strolled beside him as an Egyptian scribe, bald-headed, hairy of leg, busily arguing with him on the philosophy of worlds. He claimed that any connection between the two must be for a purpose. It was the job of magicians and spirits to work toward a closer understanding of what this purpose was. I regarded this, politely, as utter balderdash. What little interaction there was between our worlds was nothing but a cruel aberration, the enslavement of us jinn, which should be terminated as soon as possible. Our argument had become heated, and earthly vulgarities were avoided only by my concern for rhetorical purity. One or two scholars passed us as we went. Disputatious Greeks, lean Romans, hot of eye and scrubbed of skin, dark Nabataeans, and courteous diplomats from Mero and far Parthia, all here to drink knowledge from the deep Egyptian wells. As we were about to leave the library compound, a clash of horns sounded in the street below. Up came a little knot of soldiers, the Ptolemaic colours aflutter on their pikes. They drew apart to reveal Ptolemy's cousin, the king's son and heir to the throne of Egypt, slowly swaggering up the steps. In his train came an adoring cluster of favourites, toadies and fauners to a man. They included senior priests, nobles of the realm, flophouse drinking partners, professional wrestlers, a bearded lady, and a midget. The king's son had a jaded appetite and broad tastes. His social circle was wide. My master and I stopped. We inclined our heads in the traditional manner of respect. "Cousin!" The king's son lolled to a stop. His tunic was tight about his stomach, wet where the brief walk had drawn sweat from his flesh. His face was blurry with wine, his aura sagged with it. His eyes were dull coins under their heavy lids. "Cousin," he said again, "thought I'd pay you a little visit." Ptolemy bowed again. "My lord, it is an honour, of course." "Thought I'd see where you skulk away your days instead of staying at my side." He took a breath. "Like a loyal cousin should." The toadies tittered. "Philip and Alexander and all my other cousins are accounted for," he went on, tumbling over the words. "They fight for us in the desert. They work as ambassadors in principalities east and west. They prove their loyalty to our dynasty. But you—" A pause. He picked at the wet cloth of his tunic. "Well, can we rely on you?" "In whatever way you wish me to serve." "But can we, Ptolemaeus? You cannot hold a sword or draw a bow with those girlish arms of yours. So where's your strength, eh? Up here?" He tapped his head with an unsteady finger. "That's what I've heard. Up here. What do you do in this dismal place, then, out of the sun?" Ptolemy bowed his head modestly. "I study, my lord." the papyri and books of record that the worthy priests have compiled, time out of mind, works of history and religion, and magic, too, by all accounts, forbidden works. That was a tall priest, black-robed, head-shaven, and with white clay daubed faintly around his eyes. He spat the words out softly, like a cobra shooting venom. He was probably a magician himself. "Ha, yes, all manner of wickednesses." The king's son lurched a little closer. Sour fumes hung about his clothes and issued from his mouth. "The people celebrate you for it, cousin. You use your magic to beguile them, to win them over to you. I hear they come daily to your house to witness your devilry. I hear all kinds of stories."
Ptolemy pursed his lips.
"Do you, my lord? That is beyond my understanding. It is true that I am pestered by some of those who have fallen low in fortune. I offer them advice, nothing more. I am just a boy, weak, as you say, and unworldly. I prefer to remain alone, seeking nothing but a little knowledge."
The affectation of humility, for it was affectation, Ptolemy's hunger for knowledge was just as ravenous as the king's son's lust for power, and far more virile, seemed to enrage the prince into a passion. His face grew dark as uncooked meat. Little snakes of spittle swayed at the corner of his mouth.
"Knowledge, eh?" he cried.
"Yes, but of what kind, and to what end? Scrolls and styluses are nothing to a proper man, but in the hands of white-skinned necromancers they can be deadlier than the strongest iron. In old Egypt, they say, eunuchs mustered armies with the stamp of a foot and swept the rightful pharaohs into the sea. I don't intend that to happen to me. What are you smirking about, slave?"
I hadn't meant to smile. It's just I enjoyed his account, having been in the vanguard of the army that did the sweeping 1,000 years before. It's good when you make an impression. I bowed and scraped.
"Nothing, master, nothing." "You smirked. I saw you. You dare laugh at me, the king-in-waiting."
His voice quivered. The soldiers knew the signs. Their pikes made small adjustments. Ptolemy uttered placatory noises.
"He did not intend offence, my lord. My scribe was born with an unfortunate facial tic, a grimace that in harsh light can seem a baleful smirk. It is a sad affliction."
"I will have his head stuck above the crocodile gate. Guards!"
The soldiers lowered their pikes, each keener than the rest, to drench the stones with my blood. I waited meekly for the inevitable, i.e. a whirlwind of slaughter, carried out by me. Ptolemy stepped forward.
"Please, cousin, this is ridiculous. I beg you—"
"No, I will hear no argument. The slave will die."
"Then I must tell you."
My master was suddenly very close to his brutish cousin. He seemed somehow taller, his equivalent in height. His dark eyes gazed directly into the other's watery ones, which squirmed in their sockets like a fish upon a spear. The king's son quailed and shrank from him. His soldiers and attendants shifted uneasily. The sun's warmth dimmed. The courtyard grew cloudy. One or two of the soldiers had goose pimples on their legs.
"You will leave him alone," Ptolemy said, his voice slow and clear. "He is my slave, and I say he deserves no punishment. Leave with your lackeys and return to your wine vats. Your presence here disturbs the scholars and brings no credit on our family, your insinuations likewise. Do you understand?"
The king's son had bent so far back to avoid the piercing stare that half his cape dragged on the ground. He made a noise like a marsh toad mating.
"Yes," he croaked. "Yes."
Ptolemy stepped away. Instantly he seemed to dwindle. The darkness that had gathered around the little group like a winter cloud lifted and was gone. The onlookers relaxed. Priests rubbed the backs of their necks. Nobles exhaled noisily. A midget peeped out from behind a wrestler.
"Come, Reckitt."
Ptolemy repositioned the scrolls under his arm, and glanced at the king's son with studious disinterest.
"Goodbye, cousin. I am late for lunch."
He made to step past. The king's son, white-faced and tottering, uttered an incoherent word. He lurched forward. From beneath his cloak a knife was drawn. With a snarl he lunged at Ptolemy's side. I raised a hand and gestured. There was a muffled impact, as of a masonry block landing on a bag of suet pudding. The king's son doubled over, clutching his solar plexus, mouth bubbling, eyes popping. He sank to his knees. The knife dropped impotently on the stones. Ptolemy kept walking. Four of the soldiers sprang to uncertain life. Their pikes went low, they made aggressive sounds. I swept my hands in a semicircle. Away they flew, one after the other, head first, toes last, out across the courtyard cobbles. One hit a Roman, another a Greek. A third skidded a yard upon his nose. The fourth crashed into a trader's stand and was half buried by an avalanche of sweetmeats. They lay outstretched like points upon a sundial. The others in the group were chicken. They cowered together and made no move. I kept close watch upon the old bald priest, though. I could see he was tempted to do something. But he met my eyes and decided it was best to live. Ptolemy kept walking. I followed after. We went in search of anchovy bread. When we returned, our quest fulfilled. The library precinct was quiet and still. My master knew the incident was inauspicious, but his studies were his consuming interest, and he chose to ignore the implications. But I did not, and nor did the people of Alexandria. Rumours of the matter circulated swiftly, some more creative than accurate. One account, daubed upon the harbour walls and illustrated by a lively sketch, described the king's son being bent bare-bottomed over a library table and spanked with a royal flail by demon or demons unknown. The king's son was unpopular. His humiliation was regarded with general hilarity, and Ptolemy's celebrity grew. By night I floated on the winds above the palace, conversing with the djinn. "What news?"
"News, Bartimaeus, of the king's son. His brow is heavy with wrath and fear. He mutters daily that Ptolemy might send a demon to destroy him and seize the throne. The danger pulses in his temple like a beating drum."
"But my master lives only for his writing. He has no interest in the crown."
"Even so. The king's son chews on the problem late at night and over wine. He sends emissaries out in search of men that might aid him quash this threat."
"Afa, I thank you. Fly well."
"Fly well, Bartimaeus."
Ptolemy's cousin was a fool and a sot, but I understood his fears. He himself was not a magician. The magicians of Alexandria were ineffectual shadows of the great ones of the past under whom I had toiled. The ancient pharaohs had traditionally relied upon their priests for such services, and the Greek dynasty had seen no reason to alter this policy. But whereas in the past talented individuals had made their way to Egypt to ply their trade, allowing the empire to grow strong on the backs of weeping djinn, that time had long since gone. The army was weaker than for generations, and mostly far away. In comparison, Ptolemy was powerful indeed. No question the king's son would be vulnerable should my master decide to overthrow him. Time passed. I watched and waited. The king's son found his men. Money was paid. One moonlit night, four assassins stole into the palace gardens and paid a call upon my master. As I may have mentioned, their visit was of short duration. The king's son had taken the precaution of being away from Alexandria that night. He was out in the desert hunting. When he returned, he was greeted first by a flock of carrion birds wheeling in the skies above the crocodile gate, then by the hanging corpses of three assassins. Their feet brushed against the plumes of his chariot as he passed into the city. Face mottled white and crimson, the prince retired to his chambers and was not seen for days. "Master," I said, "your life remains at risk. You must leave Alexandria."
"Quite impossible, Reckitt, as you know. The library is here."
Your cousin is your implacable foe. He will try again. And you will be here to foil him, Reckitt. I have every confidence in you. The assassins were but men. The next who come will not be human. I am sure you will cope. Do you have to squat so? It distresses me.
I am an imp today. Imps squat.
Listen, I said. Your confidence in me is gratifying, but frankly I can do without it. Just as I can do without being in the firing line when a married comes knocking on your door.
He chuckled into his goblet.
A married? I think you overestimate the ability of our court magicians. A one-legged moolah, I can believe.
Your cousin casts his net wider. He drinks long with ambassadors from Rome. And Rome, from what I hear, is where the action is right now. Every hedge magician from here to the Tigris is hastening there in search of glory.
Ptolemy shrugged. So my cousin puts himself in Rome's pocket. Why should they attack me?
So that he will be forever in their debt. And meanwhile, I'll be dead.
I let off a gust of sulphur in annoyance. My master's blithe absorption in his studies could be rather galling.
It's all right for you, I cried. You can summon up any number of us to protect your skin. What we suffer doesn't matter a fig.
I folded my wings over my snout, in the manner of a huffy bat, and hung from the bedroom rafter.
Reckitt, you have saved my life twice over. You know how grateful I am to you.
Words, words, words. Don't mean nout.
Bit of Egyptian street argo crept in here. Well, I was riled.
That's hardly fair. You know the direction of my work. I wish to understand the mechanisms that divide us, human and jinni. I seek to redress the balance, build trust between us.
Yeah, yeah. And while you do, I'm guarding your back and emptying out your privy pot.
Now you're making it up. And Hotep does that.
I'm speaking figuratively.
My point is, whenever I'm in your world, I'm trapped. You call the shots. Trust doesn't enter into it.
The imp glared out through the membrane of its wing and let out another sulphurous eruption.
Will you stop doing that? I've got to sleep in this room tonight. So you doubt my sincerity, do you?
If you want my opinion, Master, all your talk of reconciliation between our peoples is nothing but hot air.
Is that so?
My master's tone of voice hardened.
Very well, Reckitt. I take that as a challenge. I believe my studies are coming to the point when I can perhaps act as well as talk. As you know, I have studied accounts of the northern tribes. The practice there is for magicians and spirits to meet halfway. From what you and the others have told me, I think I can go one better than that.
He threw his goblet aside, got up, and began pacing around the chamber. The imp lowered its wings uneasily.
What do you mean? I don't follow you.
Oh, you won't have to follow me, the boy said. Quite the reverse. When I'm ready, I'll be following you.